You're set.
All right.
So.
I came out here in 1974, which would have been 7 years after the transition took place from the MURA, which was the Midwest University Research Association organization and a university. So I came in fairly early on the transition. The MURA book, I think I've told you that some of the members of that group wrote a book. It went to the publishers last fall, late, like November or something. And so hopefully we're going to get a copy of that.
This fall?
This past
fall. Oh, okay.
Yeah, this past November. So they've promised that since I gave them a lot of help collecting things, that I would get a signed copy of the book.
So we'll
have that to go on.
And is it a compilation of the story of MURA?
The story of MURA. Right. And so I think, you know, that's why if we start in 1967 when it became part of the university, it'll be a continuation of that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. To back up a little bit, in 1965, the Atomic Energy Commission, which is now DOE, Department of Energy, notified the MURA Corporation that they had not been successful in their bid for the new high energy accelerator, which the award went to the University of Chicago, and which is now Fermi National Lab. And so what happened, of course, between 65 and 67, there was this transition of people moving to Fermilab to become part of that, to continue on with their work in high energy physics, and moved, and a large chunk of the staff moved to Fermi to continue their work. But a small group stayed here because they wanted to use the machine. They had built the prototype machine, mm-hmm. which is what was housed up in the building on the hill up on Highway B.
And that was Tantalus.
That was Tantalus. That became Tantalus.
Okay.
At that time, it was a prototype machine, and there was a small group of folks here that wanted to convert that into a low-energy machine and do these synchrotron light studies. Now, here again, Cliff and some of the others can tell you more about it, of the, mm-hmm. the science piece of that. But and so that during the 65 to 67 time, in that time frame, you know, people sorted out who was going where, who was going to do what.
Mm-hmm.
And the University of Wisconsin and the other, I think there were 21, there were either 19 or 21 Midwestern institutions that had formed this consortium called MURA. And it was decided that the University of Wisconsin would buy out the assets of the other institutions because of it. It was the closest in proximity, physically the closest.
Okay, yeah.
And it would become part of the University of Wisconsin.
Okay.
So that happened during that 65 to 67 time frame, and on July 1st, 1967, the facility officially became part of the University of Wisconsin. At that time, there was the building now called Tantalus on the hill was where the accelerator was, and the physical sciences building. That was the two buildings that existed then. And MURA had this huge machine shop and all of that, so a lot of the things stayed here, and it became the physical sciences lab. With the idea, I believe at that time, I wasn't here and wasn't part of it, but I believe that the hope was that this was going to be a sort of a, that there really wasn't money to bring in a research group. The expectation was that it would be self-supporting. The graduate school is the one that put up the money to buy the other assets because they were the only place where there was any discretionary money available. And still to this day, it looks like graduate school centers, even though we've got all this other stuff going on out here. And so then when that
then became part of the university. Of course, the staff that stayed behind then became university employees. And so there's a whole piece of that that I know a little bit about, but not a lot. But I there's a couple of other people on campus that can give us, or that mm-hmm. were connected, that I'll get you the names on, and I'll talk to them.
What was your main role when you came here?
I came out actually as the assistant director for administration. And I can't remember what the title was then. But anyway, it was, you know, it was the administrative piece. Because at that time, there was no SRC.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a standalone unit. I mean, there was this little group of people over here that was doing research. And when I came out in 1974, I was asked by the director at the time to think about coming out and just, you know, handling the administrative piece for everything that was out here at that time.
So what did that entail?
And that was the Physical Sciences Lab and Synchrotron Radiation Center.
Okay.
And then there was another group called the Metphysics Group, which was not included in that group, and they were located here. They're the ones that have that neutron source on the other side of, you probably don't even know it's there. There's
a
trailer
and stuff. Oh, yes. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And they were part of the Medical Physics Group, but they weren't part of us. But I came out here to run the to do the administrative responsibilities for this group. And over the years, it became clear that the physical sciences lab, which was expected to be self-supporting, and this group of researchers that were trying to do research, not make money. They weren't looking to function like a business and make mm-hmm. money. They were really looking to write grants and contracts and bring in federal money to do research. Became clear that there really was two different missions. Now I'm cutting out a lot of stuff here, mm-hmm. but we can go back and fill it in. That they really had two different missions. And so later in the 80s, I think it was like 1987, one of the things that I did was worked with the campus to actually split them into two separate units.
Split
the SRC apart so that it was a standalone unit. What we had going on during that time frame was a lot of headbutting, because we had, the director of PSL technically and administratively was responsible for this group of researchers that was, conducting research and looking for funds, and mm-hmm. writing proposals and doing all of this. So it was sort of an umbrella. The PSL was the overarching umbrella and SRC was underneath it.
Okay.
And so there was a lot of the friction, a lot of in-house fighting going on, because they had two different missions in life. And it kept bumping heads, and so we split the two units. We successfully split the two units, and I believe it was 1987, but I have some paperwork that I'll pull out for you, and we'll get that. And SRC became a standalone unit within the university. And at that early on, when I first came, it was funded by the Air Force, and the Air Force then, when they decided they were no longer going to fund it, and it was then the proposal was put into National Science Foundation, and they became the official funding agency. And I don't remember exactly what year that happened either, but we'll find out. And then of course it was a lot of work, which I got involved with early on when I came, was transferring equipment from ownership of all of this equipment and all of these things that had been accumulated over the mm-hmm. years from the Air Force to the National Science Foundation. But then over the years, as SRC became a standalone unit, pretty much sort of coincided with the concept for the new storage ring, which was the Aladdin ring.
Mm-hmm.
And that proposal was put together and sent in and was funded, but it struggled. It really struggled because they couldn't get it they couldn't get the ring up and running.
Mm-hmm.
And so NSF cut off funding for a year. And the graduate school and the university picked up the funding for that 1 year in order to give SRC opportunity to try and fix what was wrong. And clearly they did. They figured out what was wrong. And there again, someone else can give you the details
yeah.
about all of that. But and so it became then, you know, the Aladdin project then got off the ground and got moving. And it's, you know, it's what exists today. It's been upgraded a few times and some things done. So there's, you know, over the years, there's a lot of stories that went on, a lot of things that happened here. And I guess, I think what I would probably, the best way for me to do it is as I think about somebody's doing things, I'll just be making notes and getting them to you.
Yeah.
Because okay. right now I can't, you know, I'm not thinking of anything in particular that mm-hmm. has to be done. But, you know, we built the staff. Obviously there was no safety program, for example. I mean, you know, that started late that we realized that we probably, the campus safety program really wasn't mm-hmm. going to suffice. We really needed to bring in our own somebody here that was keeping an eye on things here, and that's when we built the safety program, and I was part of getting that off the ground. And for a long time, the safety director reported to me, which okay. was really kind of crazy because, you know, I didn't know anything about radiation safety. I didn't know anything about common sense was about all I knew of safety. You know, okay, but for up until the time I retired, I actually wore two hats, and that I was actually PSL and SRC. And it was when the break was made between the two facilities, it was not clear how we were going to do all of this. And in a meeting with the graduate school administration, and they said, well, you know, the campus provides some campus money for the administration of centers like this, and they, what they were looking at was it was going to be very expensive. Now we're going to have two sets of administrative offices, mm-hmm. and so I said to them, well, why can't we have a shared group? They said, oh, that doesn't work. We've never seen that work. And they said, well, maybe we ought to try. So I actually established what we now have, this shared administration group, which was exactly that, in that okay. what we did was to have one office that provides accounting and purchasing and you know, all of the sort of day-to-day kinds of operations, inventory, you know, stock room, all yeah. of that, each unit having its own secretaries, but this this cumulative group that this shared group that would perform most of the other tasks that needed to be done that was necessary for running two facilities, facility management kind of issues. And we then were funded for the most part from graduate school funds.
Okay.
And if you and at some point we'll sit down with Mark Faber, who is now, you know, is my successor.
Okay.
And he can talk a little more about what he's got right now. But all of the folks in shared admin have a split appointment of some kind, but they vary in percents of time depending on what their duties are. So somebody may be 50-50, you know, 50% PSL and
okay.
50% SRC, but someone else may be 80-20 depending on what their job duties are.
And what are you right now?
Well, I'm all SRC.
Okay.
Now, because when I came back, you know, I retired and Mark was hired. And so Mark is probably 50-50, you know, because that would make sense. He needs to represent both groups. But when I came back as the director of education and outreach, and so I'm totally SRC.
Okay.
I just do SRC.
Right now, what is the point of having the joint administrative?
Well, the reason for doing it is it's just economically feasible. I mean, it's neither group could have afforded to have specialty kind of people. There was no way that SRC or PSL by themselves was big enough that they could have afford to have a personnel management expert, for example, or even a Mark kind of person who was a, you know, highly skilled management, financial management piece. So there, by combining the two pieces and sharing the responsibility for doing the financial management and the personnel management, human resources management, whatever you want to call it, we were able to bring in then people, you know, that had some expertise in those areas that we wouldn't have been able to afford to do if there had been two separate offices. We just wouldn't have been able to afford to do that.
Okay.
So that was the biggest reason. The biggest reason is financial.
Okay. From what I've learned so far is I've learned of the PSL being kind of an autonomous thing, being self-sustained in a way, and and the SRC, like you said, is working with that. How, in this connection, does the PSL benefit from at the SRC? Are they receiving the funding from the NSF, or?
No, SRC is funded primarily by the National Science Foundation, with about 10% of its budget coming from the campus.
Okay.
90%, and it may be it may fluctuate a little. I'd have to ask Mark what the actual numbers are right now, but it's sort of like a 90-10 split. 90% of the funds is coming from the National Science Foundation. 10% is coming from the campus. This is sort of normal. Sort of a normal kind of split for facilities that are, you know, supported by federal government funds. PSL and SRC really are separate units, and PSL has a completely separate mission, which is, of course, is to design and build scientific instrumentation. But their goal is to be a break-even organization, and technically, under the federal accounting guidelines, they're what's known as an SSF, which is a specialized service facility, and really should be outside of the university's cost reimbursement process, their cost sharing, or their indirect cost pool. And so they sit outside of that, where when we write a proposal, and let me just back up a little bit and explain how that works. When we ask for money from the National Science Foundation, the university says, okay, that's great, but it's going to take money to be able to administer that all the way up the line. Somebody's got to pay for that purchasing agent, somebody that's, you know, the campus one, where everything has to go through. Somebody has to pay for all of that administration that goes on in the campus, and for the buildings, and for the heat and lights, and you know, all of this kind of thing. And so there's this thing called, used to be called indirect costs, and then it was called facilities and something. There was another term in between. Now it's called F&A, which is facilities and administration. It's the cost of running the business. And the university has an established indirect cost amount, which they charge to all grants and contracts that come into the university, including from the outside, from private benefactors. Now, sometimes it can be waived, depending on what the situation is, but they do have a standard indirect cost rate. And so it oftentimes comes back to us, that those indirect costs comes back to SRC in the form of the salary money that may come down to, that say pays for part of Joe's salary as the director, and other, you know, folks that are really kind of administrative. And so those funds come back to SRC in an indirect way. Now PSL, because of the designation as a specialized service facility, does not function that way. When they don't get money back from the campus. Now, that's not entirely true, in that they do get some support. They do get the building, for example. Technically, they ought to be paying rent for the campus, to the campus, for that building. They don't, but technically, under the way the federal guidelines are for accounting purposes, the PSL sits outside of the university's indirect cost mm-hmm. pool. And so they're not, when they bring in funding, let's say they write a contract with somebody to build a piece of equipment, they incorporate, PSL incorporates its own indirect cost rate, whatever that may be. And often it's the same as the universities because that's an easy way to administer it. But they have more flexibility in that they don't have to fit into this indirect cost pool that's been reviewed and approved by the federal government. Okay. Because so they have to recover their costs, and they should recover whatever cost it is that the university would charge them. Okay. Often they're allowed to keep that money, but not always. I mean, sometimes, you know, it depends on the situation.
Okay.
So they look like two different animals.
Okay, yeah. All the relationships that you just described, when did that come about? The current day establishment of today, when was that?
You mean with the relationship between
yeah,
the two?
Well, that exists today, when was that?
That was 1987, I think,
okay.
when the two organizations split. I believe it was 1987. I can't remember if it's 85 or 87, but that's when the SRC group became its own entity.
Okay.
And that's when the shared admin group began to form.
Okay.
Was at that time, because we had to be able to, you know, we'd been doing all of it together at one time, because we were that office, all of those offices that are now in the shared admin group, the purchasing, the accounting, the personnel management, the inventory, the stock room, that was all PSL, and so it was doing both sets. So when the two organizations split, then we had to find a way to continue to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when the shared admin group was formed. And somewhere it's probably up in the archives, our archives, all the communication that went on in doing that. And so there's a lot of stuff we can dig out and include in this book. I don't know, you know, how much we want to include of all of that.
No, but that's good to understand
yeah,
the relationship,
so.
Because it is, the story of the SRC is not linear by any means.
No.
I mean, it's very scattered like that.
You were going to be pulling things
yeah.
in from all over.
One last question about that, though, is do all the parts that the SRC use come from the PSL?
No.
Okay.
PSL works with SRC like it works with many other organizations. There's no umbilical cord that connects the two. If SRC wants PSL to build something, they go through the same process that anyone else would go through. They sit down with an engineer at PSL and say, here's what we've got in mind, here's what we're thinking about. They go through a costing process, and then SRC agrees or disagrees or whatever until they arrive at some
okay.
agreement. So there is not an umbilical cord between the two. They're really separate units, and SRC deals with PSL the same way electrical engineering from the campus would, or Oscar Myers if they decided they needed something to come in. It's the same process.
Okay, so just
the thing that we share is this administrative office.
And that's to help both
and
agencies.
That's because both units benefit
okay,
with
yeah.
cost savings.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
It's an economy of scales thing.
Yeah, all right. To put it more in a chronological order of your place here, do you think you could talk about the separate groups of MIRA, from Tantalus to the PSL, and your place within, like when you came, what existed, was it Tantalus
okay.
and?
When I came,
it was fairly
simple, actually, because since the graduate school had provided the money to buy the assets, the graduate school, there would be the campus administration, and then
Here, I want to put a draw.
You could draw it on my notebook if you like.
You want it there instead?
Yeah, that would be on my notes.
So if you had, here's the campus, here's campus administration.
Mm-hmm.
The chancellor's office and, you know, so forth, the chancellor and the provost and so forth. Okay, and then down here as one of its many units is divisional units is the graduate school. And then there's engineering and L&S and,
mm-hmm.
you know, all of this sort of thing and here and, you know, human ecology and, you know, all of that. Okay. So then under the graduate school is unique here on this campus in that the graduate school is also the research office. And so that the dean of the graduate school is also the senior research officer for the UW-Madison campus.
Okay.
That's unusual. It doesn't often function that way. So the dean of the graduate school has two responsibilities. One is to the graduate students in the graduate school itself and the education of graduate students and also the administration and well-being of a set of unique or interdisciplinary type organizations of which there are currently 18 that are under the graduate school.
Okay.
So in addition to PSL and SRC, there are several other units on the campus, and you might be familiar with some of them. The Weissman Center, for example, is a graduate school function. The Research Animal Resources Group, and there's biophysics and molecular biology, not biophysics, molecular biology and molecular virology. They're all groups, centers that are multidisciplinary and they cross lines so they don't fit cleanly into L&S or into cows, you know, into agriculture or whatever. And so they're in the graduate school. So we're part of this, there's this two different functions that the graduate school has. There are the centers here and then there's the actual graduate students that mm-hmm. they're responsible for. And down here, under here, you'll have these 18 units and SRC is one.
Okay.
And PSL is one. And then you have all these other 16 of them.
So this is today?
This is today.
Okay.
You know, it was not... Well, if you wanted... The difference would be in 1974 when I came out here, or in 1967 when it became part of the university, is that these were two units. These two units were a single unit. So this was a single unit, and that was the difference.
Okay.
And today they are two separate units.
Okay.
So what happened in 1987 is that these two were split and became separate units, recognized by the campus as separate units
mm-hmm.
out here. And that's the way it is today. So, is that confusing now?
A little bit. When you came here...
When I came here...
We had the PSL that existed.
We had PSL. Okay, when I came out here, then to go down further from here, and I guess we should scratch this out here. So I think graduate school had 21 units at that time. But under the centers, there would have been one unit called PSL.
Mm-hmm.
And included in that unit, so included in here, was... this sort of subgroup of that was the beginnings of SRC, that was called SRC.
Okay, so it was.
I think it was already named by the time I came here, they'd already collected themselves enough together and named themselves the Synchrotron Radiation Center.
Okay.
But it was underneath the PSL organization.
And was it at that building across the street?
It was, yes.
Okay.
Part of it. Offices were part of the PSL building. I mean, that's where the senior scientists and those folks were all housed in the PSL building. And the actual storage ring, the machine, and the research activities were at okay. Tantalus.
Okay, good. That helps okay. a lot.
Okay. And the director of PSL was the overall director for everyone that was here, that was out here in this group, in these two groups. And then, of course, we had this sort of subgroup of scientists and things that were working, that were doing research, and they formed in their own little group, and they had their own little director who was a sub-director to the director of PSL. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of friction there okay. until it was broke apart, and then that became a separate unit with its own separate director.
Do you recall offhand when Aladdin, this building here, was starting to be built?
Yeah, that was in the 80s, and it coincided somewhat with the splitting of the two organizations.
Okay.
That was really, I think that was the deciding factor to move ahead with breaking off this unit and making two
okay.
units, because they were now going to be housed over here with their own offices and so forth. And so then that was really the kind of the last piece that had to fall into place. So they now had their own facility and their own separate offices
mm-hmm.
and so forth, and it became clear that it really made sense
okay,
to make
but yeah,
it.
That fits in with everything you said earlier about
right, that. Yeah, and it all happened about the same time,
okay.
in that 1985 to 87 time frame,
okay.
While the machine was being built and brought up and so forth.
Good.
Of course, during that whole time frame, we were, you know, my staff was, we were already sort of doing two different groups of people, because we were processing all of the work for the SRC group. All the proposals that were being written and stuff were going through the administrative office at PSL. When the two units split, It was sort of natural to keep up. I mean, we didn't really do anything different. I mean,
mm-hmm.
we weren't doing anything too much
yeah.
different. It was more of a legal split in an administrative sort
That's
of identification
a...
split more
mm-hmm.
than anything.
Okay.
In that the processes that had been put in place, we were still doing. We were still, you know, we were continuing to process the proposals, to do the purchasing, to do the
mm-hmm.
the human resources piece, all of that was.
So were things a lot simpler than
they were a lot guys? Simpler. Yes, they've gotten much more complicated over the years.
Compiling.
The regulations are what's killing. I mean, I spent a big chunk of my career out here just getting the campus. Organizations to recognize that we're part of Madison campus,
okay.
especially the physical plant. They just really didn't want to ever do anything for us because they didn't think we were part of it. And I struggled and struggled and fought a lot of battles just to be recognized as part of UW-Madison. And we still do. It's still amazing that people on campus, that there are lots of people on campus that don't have a clue that we're out here.
I certainly do.
And that we're part of Madison campus. It's still an education process. You know,
mm-hmm.
we still need to, which is one of the reasons this would be really good. I think
yeah.
it would help in the education
at what,
process.
At what point did the outreach program start up?
The education and outreach piece for SRC started, I'm trying to think back when, and Jim Taylor was director, and it's probably been going on maybe 7-8 years. I'm trying to think. The research experience for undergraduate programs started in 2001, I think, or 2002. But prior to that, it was kind of a loosely knit kind of some ideas about how things, you know, things that could be done for as far as getting, you know, thinking about how high school programs could be brought in and things, and so over the years, and it was kind of loosely pulled together. actually what we need to do is talk to Jim Taylor, because Jim's the one who started it. And I didn't get involved until Jim actually retired, and then we needed to keep the program going and to build it, because as you know, the National Science Foundation, science education is a very big part of their mission.
Chris was telling me that the NSF required places like this to start an outreach program.
Yeah, and that, but I don't know for sure exactly what year that was, and it wasn't until Jim sort of semi-retired, and then it was clear that we needed to put some other resources in it, and I started picking up some of it, even in my responsibilities as the administrative person. And so more and more of it I got involved with as I went along, and decided I really was enjoying it and having a good time. And that was so when I decided it was maybe time for me to move aside and let somebody new come in and with the administrative piece of it. And when I talked to Joe, and Joe said, you can't do that, you can't retire. And I said, well, how about if I come back as the education and outreach director? And so that's what we did. And I've really had, really enjoying, have enjoyed it, and still am enjoying it. It was a new opportunity for me. It was an opportunity to learn some new things, to build some new networks, meet some new people, some different people than I had before, and yet be able to utilize all the contacts that I already had, because having spent 30 some years on the campus, I know a big chunk of people out there.
Well, I'm sure they also are happy to have you at hand for things.
So it was an opportunity for me to be able to continue to be involved, and I'm excited about the things that are being talked about for SRC and the new FEL ring and all of that. I just think it's exciting stuff, and I'm going to continue to be part of it for a while at least. We'll see how it goes. Depends on what happens with the funding issues, and I'm not sure I want to work 100% time again, it's kind of nice having a day off now and then.
Yeah.
I've, over the years, my friends jokingly say to me, sure, now you're working part-time, that means you work 40 hours a week instead of 80, and I said, well, yeah, I suppose that's some of it, but, it does mean that I have a little more free time, and I can go and do some things, and my husband's been retired for, gosh, 6-7 years now already, and he's happy. He likes puttering around. We live on a farm, and so he's got lots of space, and he's happy to have me. I think he's happy to have me working, because I think I'd drive him nuts. He's not happy with me today, because I left him with a project this morning, because we were going to paint the kitchen, which shouldn't have taken much effort at all, except the painter didn't show up before I left, and so he got stuck with it. So,
that's good.
But anyway, I got involved probably about 5 years ago, I think, in working with Jim and with Chris to start building some of these things and start expanding on them and. Getting programs built up, and I have to go back, my memories, there's so much there, I can't remember dates anymore, they all kind of roll together after a while, they all look, you say, oh, that couldn't possibly have been, not possible that was 10 years ago, well, it is, because it seemed like it is. So that's how I essentially got involved in this area, was matter of moving aside, and after having done all of these things and built all these programs and stuff, I was a little tired. I mean, it was time to do something new. I don't know that tired was the right word. I think I needed a new challenge and something that was different, that would excite me and get me motivated to do things. And so that's why this worked out. If I weren't here, I'd be doing something
else. Mm-hmm. So, you know, coming back here's been really fun to work and stay involved with the people. There's great people here. I like all the people, and it's fun to see people become successful. And to watch, a lot of people have come in and worked for me and then gone on to the campus and become successful, and it's a good feeling to have that happen, to be able to look at him and say, yeah, you know, it's everything he knows he learned from me, you know. but to build the basis for that and to see, so it's been very fulfilling. So I think probably maybe this is sort of a good basis.
Yeah.